doesn't. Weren't you ever wrong before?
Of course I was. Lots of times.
But
I don't think I'm wrong now.
So why exactly?
She asked again. Because I know things about people, Alice.
So do I,
she said.
Like, I know Carmen Greer suckered you, too. He said nothing more,
just watched her drive and looked at the view ahead. He could see mountains in the distance, where Carmen had chased the school bus. He had the FedEx packet on his knees. He fanned himself with it, balanced it on his fingers, turned it over and over, aimlessly, stared down at the front and the back, at the orange and purple logo, at the label, at the meaningless little words all over it. Sender, addressee, extremely urgent, commodity description, dimensions in inches, 12x9, weight in pounds, 2.6, payment, recipient's contact information, overnight, no post office box number, shipper must check. This shipment does not contain dangerous goods. He shook his head and pitched it behind him onto the back seat. She had no money with her, he said.
Alice said nothing back, just drove on, piloting the tiny car fast and economically. He could feel her pitying him.
It was suddenly coming off her in waves. What? He said.
We should turn around, she said. This is a complete waste of time.
Why?
Because exactly what is Ellie going to tell us? I mean, I can follow your thinking.
If Carmen really did get a broken arm, then she must have been wearing a plaster cast for 6 weeks. And Ellie's a smart kid, so she'll recall it. Same for the jaw thing. Broken jaw, you're all wired up for a spell. Certainly a kid would remember that. If any of this really happened, and if it happened recently enough that she can remember anything at all.
But we know she was never in a cast. We know she never had her jaw wired. We've got her medical records, remember? They're right here in the car with us. Everything she ever went to the hospital for. Or do you think setting bones is a do-it-yourself activity? You think the blacksmith did it in the barn? So the very best Ellie can do is confirm what we already know. And most likely, she won't remember anything anyway because she's just a kid. So this trip is a double waste of time.
Let's do it anyway, he said. We're halfway there already. She might recall something useful. And I want to see her again. She's a great kid.
I'm sure she is,
Alice said.
But spare yourself, okay? Because what are you going to do? Adopt her? She's the one with the raw end of this deal, so you might as well accept it and forget all about her.
They didn't speak again until they arrived at the crossroads with the diner and the school and the gas station. Alice parked exactly where Carmen had, and they got out together into the heat. I better come with you, Reacher said. She knows me. We can bring her out and talk in the car. They went through the wire gate into the yard, then through the main door into the schoolhouse itself, into the school smell. They were out again a minute later. Ellie Greer wasn't there, and she hadn't been there the day before, either.
Understandable, I guess, Alice said. Traumatic time for her.
Reacher nodded. So let's go. It's only another hour south.
Great,
Alice said. They got back in the VW and drove the next 60 miles of parched emptiness without talking. It took a little less than an hour because Alice drove faster than Carmen had wanted to. Reacher recognized the landmarks. He saw the old oil field on the distant horizon off to the left. Greer 3. "It's coming up," he said. Alice slowed. The red-painted picket fence replaced the wire, and the gate swam into view through the haze. Alice braked and turned in under it. The small car bounced uncomfortably across the yard. She stopped it close to the bottom of the familiar porch steps and turned off the motor. The whole place was silent, no activity. But people were home, because all the cars were lined up in the vehicle barn. The white Cadillac was there, and the Jeep Cherokee, and the new pickup, and the old pickup. They were all crouched there in the shadows. They got out of the car and stood for a second behind the open doors, like they offered protection from something. The air was very still, and hotter than ever. Easily 110 degrees, maybe more. He led her up the porch steps into the shadow of the roof and knocked on the door. It opened almost immediately. Rusty Greer was standing there. She was holding a .22 rifle, one-handed. She stayed silent for a long moment, just looking him over. Then she spoke. "It's you," she said. "I thought it might be Bobby." "You lost him?" Reacher said. Rusty shrugged.
"He went out. He isn't back yet."
Reacher glanced back at the motor barn. "All the cars are here," he said.
"Somebody picked him up," Rusty said. "I was upstairs. Didn't see them. Just heard them."
Reacher said nothing.
"Anyway," Rusty said, "I didn't expect to see you again, ever."
"This is Carmen's lawyer," Reacher said. Rusty turned and glanced at Alice.
"This is the best she could do."
"We need to see Ellie."
"What for?"
"We're interviewing witnesses."
"A child can't be a witness." "I'll decide that," Alice said.
Rusty just smiled at her.
"Ellie's not here," she said.
"Well, where is she?" Reacher said. "She's not in school."
Rusty said nothing. "Mrs. Greer, we need to know where Ellie is," Alice said.
Rusty smiled again.
"I don't know where she is, lawyer girl."
"Why not?" Alice asked.
"Because family services took her. That's why not."
"When?"
"This morning. They came for her."
"And you let them take her?" Reacher said.
"Why wouldn't I? I don't want her, now that Sloop is gone."
Reacher stared at her. "But she's your granddaughter." Rusty made a dismissive gesture. The rifle moved in her hand.
"That's a fact I was never thrilled about," she said.
"Where did they take her?"
"An orphanage, I guess,"
Rusty said.
"And then she'll get adopted, if anybody wants her, which they probably won't.
I understand half-breeds are very difficult to place. Decent folk generally don't want beaner trash."
There was silence, just the tiny sounds of dry earth baking in the heat.
"I hope you get a tumor," Reacher said.
He turned around and walked back to the car without waiting for Alice, got in and slammed the door, and sat staring forward with his face burning and his massive hands clenching and unclenching. She got in beside him and fired up the motor.
"Get me out of here," he said.
She took off in a cloud of dust. Neither of them spoke a single word all the way north to Pecos.
It was 3 in the afternoon when they got back, and the legal mission was half empty because of the heat. There was the usual thicket of messages on Alice's desk. Five of them were from Hack Walker. They made a neat little sequence, each of them more urgent than the last.
"Shall we go?"
Alice asked. "Don't tell him about the diamond," Reacher said.
"It's over now, don't you see?"
And it was. Reacher saw it right away in Walker's face. There was relaxation there, some kind of finality, closure, some kind of peace. He was sitting behind his desk. His desk was all covered with papers. They were arranged in two piles. One was taller than the other.
"What?" Reacher asked.
Walker ignored him and handed a single sheet to Alice.
"Waiver of her Miranda rights," he said. "Read it carefully. She's declining legal representation, and she's declaring that it's entirely voluntary. And she adds that she refused your representation from the very start."
"I doubted her competence," Alice said.
Walker nodded. "I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, but there's no doubt now. So you're here purely as a courtesy, okay? Both of you." Then he handed over the smaller pile of papers. Alice took them and fanned them out, and Reacher leaned to his right to look at them. They were computer printouts. They were all covered in figures and dates. They were bank records, balance statements and transaction listings, credits and debits. There seemed to be five separate accounts. Two were regular checking accounts. Three were money market deposits. They were titled Greer Non-Discretionary Trust, numbers 1 through 5. The balances were healthy. Very healthy. There was a composite total somewhere near $2 million.
"Al Eugene's people messengered them over," Walker said.
"Now, look at the bottom sheets." Alice riffed through. The bottom sheets were paper-clipped together. Reacher read over her shoulder. There was a lot of legal text. It added up to the formal minutes of a trust agreement. There was a notarized deed attached. It stated, in relatively straightforward language, that for the time being a single trustee was in absolute sole control of all Sloop Greer's funds. That single trustee was identified as Sloop Greer's legal wife, Carmen.
"She had $2 million in the bank," Walker said.
"All hers, effectively." Reacher glanced at Alice. She nodded.
"He's right," she said.
"Now, look at the last clause of the minutes," Walker said.
Alice turned the page. The last clause concerned reversion. The trusts would become discretionary once again and return the funds to Sloop's own control at a future date to be specified by him, unless he first became irreversibly mentally incapacitated, or died, whereupon all existing balances would become Carmen's sole property, in the first instance as a matter of prior agreement, and in the second as a matter of inheritance.
"Is all of that clear?" Walker asked.
Reacher said nothing, but Alice nodded. Then Walker passed her the taller pile.
"Now read this," he said.
"What is it?" she asked.
"A transcript," Walker said,
"of her confession."
There was silence.
"She confessed?" Alice said.
"We videotaped it," Walker said.
"When?"
"Noon today. My assistant went to see her as soon as the financial stuff came in. We tried to find you first, but we couldn't. Then she told us she didn't want a lawyer anyway, so we had her sign the waiver. Then she spilled her guts. We brought her up here and videotaped the whole thing over again. It's not pretty."
Reacher was half listening, half reading. It wasn't pretty, that was for damn sure. It started out with all the usual assurances about free will and absolute absence of coercion. She stated her name, went all the way back to her L.A. days. She had been an illegitimate child. She had been a hooker. Street stroller, she called it. Some odd barrio expression, Reacher assumed. Then she came off the streets and started stripping, and changed her title to sex worker. She had latched on to Sloop, just like Walker had claimed. My meal ticket, she called him. Then it became a story of impatience. She was bored witless in Texas. She wanted out, but she wanted money in her pocket. The more money, the better. Sloop's IRS trouble was a godsend. The trusts were tempting. She tried to have him killed in prison, which she knew from her peers was possible, but she found out that a federal minimum security facility wasn't that sort of a place. So she waited. As soon as she heard he was getting out, she bought the gun and went recruiting. She planned to leverage her marks with invented stories about domestic violence. Reacher's name was mentioned as the last pick. He had refused, so she did it herself. Having already fabricated the abuse claims, she intended to use them to get off with self-defense or diminished responsibility or whatever else she could manage. But then she realized her hospital records would come up blank, so she was confessing and throwing herself on the mercy of the prosecutor. Her signature was scrawled on the bottom of every page. Alice was a slow reader. She came to the end a full minute after him.
I'm sorry, Reacher, she said.
There was silence for a moment.
What about the election? Reacher asked.
The last hope. Walker shrugged.
Texas code says it's a capital crime. Murder for remuneration. We've got enough evidence to choke a pig, and I can't ignore a voluntary confession, can I? So, a couple hours ago, I was pretty down. But then I got to thinking about it. Fact is, a voluntary confession helps me out. A confession and a guilty plea saves the taxpayer the cost of a trial, justifies me asking for a life sentence instead. The way I see it, with a story like that, she's going to look very, very bad, whoever you are. So if I back off the death penalty, I'll look magnanimous in comparison. Generous, even. The whites will fret a little, but the Mexicans will eat it up with a spoon. See what I mean? The whole thing is reversed now. She was the good guy. I was the heavy hand. But now she's the heavy hand, and I'm the good guy. So I think I'm okay. Nobody spoke for another minute. There was just the omnipresent roar of the air conditioners.
I've got her property, Alice said. A belt and a ring.
Take them to storage, Walker said. We'll be moving her later.
Where?
The penitentiary. We can't keep her here anymore.
No, where's storage?
Same building as the morgue. Make sure you get a receipt.
Reacher walked with her over to the morgue. He wasn't aware of taking a single step, wasn't aware of the heat, or the dust, or the noise, or the traffic, or the smells of the street. He felt like he was floating an inch above the sidewalk, insulated inside some kind of sensory deprivation suit. Alice was talking to him, time to time, but he was hearing nothing that she said. All he could hear was a small voice inside his head that was saying, "You were wrong. Completely wrong." It was a voice he had heard before, but that didn't make it any easier to hear again, because he had built his whole career on hearing it fewer times than the next guy. It was like a box score in his mind, and his average had just taken some serious damage, which upset him. Not because of vanity. It upset him because he was a professional who was supposed to get things right.
Reacher?
Alice was saying.
You're not listening, are you?
What? He said.
I asked you, do you want to get a meal?
No, he said. I want to get a ride. She stopped walking.
What now? Quadruple check?
No, I mean out of here. I want to go somewhere else, a long way away. I hear Antarctica is nice this time of year.
The bus depot is on the way back to the office.
Good. I'll take a bus. Because I'm all done hitchhiking. You never know who's going to pick you up.
The morgue was a low industrial shed in a paved yard behind the street. It could have been a brake shop or a tire depot. It had metal siding and a roll-up vehicle door. There was a personnel entrance at the far end of the building. It had two steps up to it, framed by handrails fabricated from steel pipe. Inside, it was very cold. There were industrial-strength air conditioners running full blast. It felt like a meat store, which it was, in a way. To the left of the foyer was a double door that gave directly onto the morgue operation. It was standing open, and Reacher could see the autopsy tables. There was plenty of stainless steel and white tile and fluorescent light in there. Alice put the lizard skin belt on the reception counter and dug in her pocketbook for the ring. She told the attendant they were for Texas versus Carmen Greer. He went away and came back with the evidence box.
No, it's personal property, she said. Not evidence. I'm sorry.
The guy gave her a why-didn't-you-say-so look and turned around.
Wait, Reacher called.
Let me see that. The guy paused, and then he turned back and slid the box across the counter. It had no lid, so it was really just a cardboard tray maybe 3 inches deep. Somebody had written Greer on the front edge with a marker pen. The Larson was in a plastic bag with an evidence number. Two brass shell cases were in a separate bag. Two tiny 22 bullets were in a bag each. They were gray and very slightly distorted. One bag was marked Intercranial Number 1, and the other was marked Intercranial Number 2. They had reference numbers and signatures.
Is the pathologist here? Reacher asked.
Sure, the counter guy said. He's always here.
I need to see him, Reacher said. Right now.
He was expecting objections, but the guy just pointed to the double doors.
In there,
he said. Alice hung back, but Reacher went through. At first, he thought the room was empty, but then he saw a glass door in the far corner. Behind it was an office with a man in green scrubs at a desk. He was doing paperwork. Reacher knocked on the glass. The man looked up, mouthed, "Come in." Reacher went in.
"Help you?" the guy said. "Only two bullets in Sloop Greer," Reacher said.
"Who are you?"
"I'm with the perp's lawyer," Reacher said. "She's outside."
"The perp?"
"No, the lawyer."
"Okay," the guy said.
"What about the bullets?"
"How many were there?"
"Two," the guy said.
"Hell of a time getting them out."
"Can I see the body?"
"Why?"
"I'm worried about a miscarriage of justice."
It's a line that usually works with pathologists. They figure there's going to be a trial. They figure they'll be called on for evidence. The last thing they want is to be humiliated by the defense on cross-examination. It's bad for their scientific image and their egos, so they prefer to get any doubts squared away beforehand.
"Okay," he said. "It's in the freezer."
He had another door in back of his office which led to a dim corridor. At the end of the corridor was an insulated steel door, like a meat locker.
"Cold in there," he said. Reacher nodded. I'm glad somewhere is.
The guy operated the handle, and they went inside. The light was bright. There were fluorescent tubes all over the ceiling. There was a bank of 27 stainless steel drawers on the far wall, 9 across, 3 high. 8 of them were occupied. They had tags slipped into little receptacles on the front, the sort of thing you see on office filing cabinets. The air in the room was frosty. Reacher's breath clouded in front of him. The pathologist checked the tags and slid a drawer. It came out easily, on cantilevered runners.
Had to take the back of his head off, he said. Practically had to scoop his brains out with a soup ladle before I found them.
Sloop Greer was on his back and naked. He looked small and collapsed in death. His skin was gray like unfired clay. It was hard with cold. His eyes were open, blank and staring. He had 2 bullet holes in his forehead, about 3 inches apart. They were neat holes, blue and ridged at the edges like they had been carefully drilled there by a craftsman.
Classic 22 gunshot wounds, the pathologist said. The bullets go in okay, but they don't come out again. Too slow, not enough power. They just rattle around in there. But they get the job done.
Reacher closed his eyes. Then he smiled, a big, broad grin.
That's for sure, he said. They get the job done.
There was a knock at the open door, a low sound like soft knuckles against hard steel. Reacher opened his eyes again. Alice was standing there shivering.
What are you doing?
She called to him.
What comes after quadruple check?
He called back. His breath hung in the air in front of him like a shaped cloud.
Quintuple check,
she said.
Why?
And after that?
Sextuple,
she said.
Why?
Because we're going to be doing a whole lot of checking now.
Why?
Because there's something seriously wrong here, Alice. Come take a look.
14. Alice walked slowly across the tile.
What's wrong?
She asked. Tell me what you see, Reacher said. She dropped her eyes toward the corpse like it required a physical effort.
Shot in the head, she said, twice.
How far apart are the holes?
Maybe 3 inches.
What else do you see?
Nothing,
she said.
He nodded. Exactly.
So?
Look closer. The holes are clean, right?
She took a step nearer the drawer, bent slightly from the waist.
They look clean,
she said.
That has implications, he said. It means they're not contact wounds.
A contact wound is where you put the muzzle of the gun directly against the forehead. You know what happens when you do that? She shook her head, said nothing. First thing out of a gun barrel is an explosion of hot gas. If the muzzle was tight against the forehead, the gas punches in under the skin and then can't go anyplace because of the bone. So it punches right back out again. It tears itself a big, star-shaped hole. Looks like a starfish. Right, Doc? The pathologist nodded.
Starburst splitting, we call it,
he said.
That's absent here, Reacher said. So it wasn't a contact shot.
Next thing out of the barrel is flame. If it was a real close shot, 2 or 3 inches, but not a contact shot, we'd see burning of the skin in a small ring shape.
Burn rim,
the pathologist said.
That's absent too, Reacher said.
Next thing out is soot, soft, smudgy black stuff. So if it was a shot from 6 or 8 inches, we'd see soot smudging on his forehead.
maybe a patch a couple inches wide. That's not here either.
So?
Alice asked. Next thing out is gunpowder particles, Reacher said. Little bits of unburned carbon. No gunpowder is perfect. Some of it doesn't burn. It just blasts out in a spray. It hammers in under the skin. Tiny black dots. Tattooing, it's called. If it was a shot from a foot away, maybe a foot and a half, we'd see it. You see it?
No,
Alice said. Right. All we see is the bullet holes. Nothing else. No evidence at all to suggest they were from close range. Depends on the exact powder in the shells, but they look to me like shots from 3 or 4 feet away. Absolute minimum. 8 feet 6 inches, the pathologist said. That's my estimation. Reacher glanced at him. You tested the powder? The guy shook his head. Crime scene diagrams. He was on the far side of the bed. The bed was near the window, gave him an alley 2 feet 6 inches wide on his side. He was found near the bedside table, up near the head against the window wall. We know she wasn't next to him there, or we'd have found all that close-range stuff you just mentioned. So the nearest she could have been was on the other side of the bed, at the foot end, probably, firing across it diagonally according to the trajectories. He was probably retreating as far as he could get. It was a king-size bed, so my best guess is 8 feet 6 inches to allow for the diagonal. Excellent, Reacher said. You prepared to say so on the stand?
Sure.
And that's only the theoretical minimum. Could have been more.
But what does it mean?
Alice asked. Means Carmen didn't do it, Reacher said.
Why not?
How big is a man's forehead? 5 inches across and 2 high?
So?
No way she could have hit a target that small from 8 feet plus.
How do you know?
Because I saw her shoot the day before. First time she pulled a trigger in her life, she was hopeless. Literally hopeless. She couldn't have hit the side of a barn from 8 feet plus. I told her she'd have to jam the gun in his gut and empty the magazine.
You're digging her grave, Alice said. That sort of testimony shouldn't be volunteered.
She didn't do it, Alice. She couldn't have.
She could have gotten lucky.
Sure, once, but not twice. Twice means they were aimed shots, and they're close together, horizontally. He'd have started falling after the first one, which means it was a fast double tap. Bang, bang. Like that. No hesitation. That's skillful shooting. Alice was quiet for a second.
She could have been faking, she said. You know, before, about needing to learn. She lied about everything else. Maybe she was really an expert shot, but she claimed not to be, because she wanted you to do it for her. For other reasons.
Reacher shook his head. She wasn't faking, he said. All my life I've seen people shoot. Either you can or you can't. And if you can, it shows. You can't hide it. You can't unlearn it.
Alice said nothing.
It wasn't Carmen, Reacher said. Even I couldn't have done it. Not with that piece of junk she bought. Not from that distance. A fast double tap to the head? Whoever did this is a better shooter than me. Alice smiled faintly.
And that's rare?
Very, he said, unselfconsciously.
But she confessed to it. Why would she do that?
I have no idea. Ellie wasn't sure she understood completely.
She had hidden on the stairs above the foyer when her grandmother talked to the strangers. She had heard the words, new family. She understood what they meant, and she already knew she needed a new family. The Greers had told her that her daddy had died, and her mommy had gone far away and wasn't ever coming back. And they had told her they didn't want to keep her with them, which was okay with her. She didn't want to stay with them either. They were mean. They had already sold her pony, and all the other horses, too. A big truck had come for them, very early that morning. She didn't cry. She just somehow knew it all went together. No more daddy, no more mommy, no more pony, no more horses. Everything had changed. So she went with the strangers, because she didn't know what else to do. Then the strangers had let her talk to her mommy on the phone. Her mommy had cried, and at the end she said, "Be happy with your new family." But the thing was, she wasn't sure if these strangers were her new family, or if they were just taking her to her new family. And she was afraid to ask, so she just kept quiet. The back of her hand was sore where she put it in her mouth. "It's a can of worms," Hack Walker said. "You know what I mean? Best not to open it at all. Things could get out of hand. Real quick." They were back in Walker's office. It was easily 50 degrees hotter than the interior of the morgue building. They were both sweating heavily. "You understand?" Walker asked. "It makes things worse again."
"You think?"
Alice said. Walker nodded.
"It muddies the waters. Let's say Reacher is right, which is a stretch, frankly, because all he's got is a highly subjective opinion here. He's guessing, basically. And his guess is based on what, exactly? It's based on an impression she chose to give him beforehand that she couldn't shoot. And we already know every other impression she chose to give him beforehand was total bullshit from beginning to end. But let's say he's right, just for the sake of argument. What does that give us?"
"What?"
"A conspiracy is what. We know she tried to rope Reacher in. Now you've got her roping somebody else in. She gets a hold of somebody else. She tells them to come to the house. She tells them where and when. She tells them where her gun is concealed. They show up, get the gun, do the deed. If it happened that way, she's instigated a conspiracy to commit murder for remuneration. Hired a killer. Cold-blooded as hell. We go down that road, she's headed for the lethal injection again, because that looks a whole lot worse than a solo shot, believe me. In comparison, a solo shot looks almost benign. It looks like a crime of the moment, you know? We leave it exactly the way we got it, along with the guilty plea. I'm happy asking for a life sentence, but we start talking conspiracy? That's real evil, and we're back on track for death row."
Alice said nothing.
"So, you see what I mean?" Walker said. "There's no net benefit. Absolutely the opposite effect. It makes things much worse for her. Plus, she already said she did it herself, which I think is true. But if it isn't, then her confession was a calculated lie, designed to cover her ass because she knew a conspiracy would look worse. And we'd have to react to that. We couldn't let that go. It would make us look like fools."
Alice said nothing. Reacher just shrugged.
"So leave it alone," Walker said. "That's my suggestion. If it would help her, I'd look at it, but it won't, so we should leave it alone.
for her sake. And for your judgeship's sake, Reacher said. Walker nodded. I'm not hiding that from you.
You happy to leave it alone? Alice asked. As a prosecutor? Somebody could be getting clean away with something.
Walker shook his head. If it happened the way Reacher thinks. If is a very big word. I gotta say, I think it's highly unlikely. Believe me, I'm a real enthusiastic prosecutor, but I wouldn't build a case and waste the jury's time on one person's purely subjective opinion about how well another person could shoot, especially when that other person is as accomplished a liar as Carmen is. All we know, she's been shooting every day since she was a kid, a rough kid from some barrio in L.A. Certainly a rural Texas jury wouldn't see any problem in swallowing that.
Reacher said nothing. Alice nodded again.
Okay, she said. I'm not her lawyer anyway.
What would you do if you were?
She shrugged.
I'd leave it, probably. Like you say, blundering into a conspiracy rap wouldn't help her any.
She stood up slowly, like it was an effort in the heat. She tapped Reacher on the shoulder, gave him a what can we do look, and headed for the door. He stood up and followed her. Walker said nothing, just watched them partway out of the room, and then dropped his eyes to the old photograph of the three boys leaning on the pickup's fender. They crossed the street together and walked as far as the bus depot. It was 50 yards from the courthouse, 50 yards from the legal mission. It was a small, sleepy depot. No buses in it. Just an expanse of diesel-stained blacktop, ringed with benches shaded from the afternoon sun by small, white fiberglass roofs. There was a tiny office hut, papered on the outside with schedules. It had a through-the-wall air conditioner running hard. There was a woman in it, sitting on a high stool, reading a magazine.
Walker's right, you know, Alice said. He's doing her a favor. It's a lost cause.
Reacher said nothing.
So where will you head?
She asked.
First bus out, he said. That's my rule.
They stood together and read the schedules. Next departure was to Topeka, Kansas, via Oklahoma City. It was due in from Phoenix, Arizona in a half hour. It was making a long, slow, counterclockwise loop.
Been to Topeka before?
Alice asked.
I've been to Leavenworth, he said. It's not far.
He tapped on the glass, and the woman sold him a one-way ticket. He put it in his pocket.
Good luck, Alice, he said. 4.5 years from now, I'll look for you in the yellow pages.
She smiled.
Take care, Reacher,
she said. She stood still for a second, like she was debating whether to hug him or kiss him on the cheek or just walk away. Then she smiled again and just walked away. He watched her go until she was lost to sight. Then he found the shadiest bench and sat down to wait.
She still wasn't sure. They had taken her to a very nice place, like a house with beds and everything, so maybe this was her new family. But they didn't look like a family. They were very busy. She thought they looked a bit like doctors. They were kind to her, but busy too, with stuff she didn't understand, like at the doctor's office. Maybe they were doctors. Maybe they knew she was upset, and they were going to make her better. She thought about it for a long time, and then she asked.
Are you doctors?
She said.
No, they answered.
Are you my new family?
No,
they said. You'll go to your new family soon.
When?
A few days, okay? But right now, you stay with us. She thought they all looked very busy. The bus rolled in more or less on time. It was a big Greyhound, dirty from the road, wrapped in a diesel cloud with heat shimmering visibly from its air conditioner grills. It stopped 20 feet from him, and the driver held the engine at a loud, shuddering idle. The door opened, and three people got off. Reacher stood up and walked over and got on. He was the only departing passenger. The driver took his ticket.
2 minutes, okay?
The guy said. I need a comfort stop. Reacher nodded and said nothing, just shuffled down the aisle and found a double seat empty. It was on the left, which would face the evening sun all the way after they turned north at Abilene. But the windows were tinted dark blue, and the air was cold, so he figured he'd be okay. He sat down sideways, stretched out, and rested his head against the glass. The 8 spent shells in his pocket were uncomfortable against the muscle of his thigh. He hitched up and moved them through the cotton. Then he took them out and held them in his palm, rolled them together like dice. They were warm, and they made dull, metallic sounds. Abilene, he thought. The driver climbed back in and hung off the step and looked both ways, like an old railroad guy. Then he slid into his seat, and the door wheezed shut behind him.
Wait,
Reacher called. He stood up and shuffled forward again all the way down the aisle.
I changed my mind, he said. I'm getting off.
I already canceled your ticket, the driver said.
You want a refund? You'll have to mail a claim.
I don't want a refund, Reacher said. Just let me out, okay?
The driver looked blank, but he operated the mechanism anyway, and the doors wheezed open again. Reacher stepped down into the heat and walked away. He heard the bus leave behind him. It turned right where he had turned left, and he heard its noise fade and die into the distance. He walked on to the law office. Working hours elsewhere were over, and it was crowded again with groups of quiet, worried people, some of them talking to lawyers, some of them waiting to. Alice was at her desk in back, talking to a woman with a baby on her knee. She looked up, surprised.
"Bus didn't come?"
she asked. "I need to ask you a legal question," he said.
"Is it quick?"
He nodded. "Civilian law. If some guy tells an attorney about a crime, how far can the cops press the attorney for the details?"
"It would be privileged information," Alice said, "between lawyer and client. The cops couldn't press at all."
"Can I use your phone?" She paused a moment, puzzled, then she shrugged.
"Sure," she said. "Squeeze in."
He took a spare client chair and put it next to hers, behind the desk. "Got phone books for Abilene?" he asked.
"Bottom drawer," she said. "All of Texas."
She turned back to the woman with the baby and restarted their discussion in Spanish. He opened the drawer and found the right book. There was an information page near the front, with all the emergency services laid out in big letters. He dialed the state police. Abilene office. A woman answered and asked how she could help him.
"I have information," he said, "about a crime."
The woman put him on hold. Maybe 30 seconds later, the call was picked up elsewhere. Sounded like a squad room. Other phones were ringing in the background, and there was faint people noise all around.
"Sergeant Rodriguez," a voice said.
"I have information about a crime," Reacher said again.
"Your name, sir?"
"Chester A. Arthur," Reacher said. "I'm a lawyer in Pecos County."
"Okay, Mr. Arthur, go ahead."
You guys found an abandoned automobile south of Abilene on Friday. A Mercedes-Benz belonging to a lawyer called Al Eugene. He's currently listed as a missing person. There was the sound of a keyboard pattering.
Okay, Rodriguez said. What can you tell me?
I have a client here who says Eugene was abducted from his car and killed very near the scene.
What's your client's name, sir?
Can't tell you that, Reacher said. Privileged information. And the fact is, I'm not sure I even believe him. I need you to check his story from your end. If he's making sense, then maybe I can persuade him to come forward.
What is he telling you?
He says Eugene was flagged down and put in another car. He was driven north to a concealed location on the left-hand side of the road, and then he was shot and his body was hidden. Alice had stopped her conversation and was staring sideways at him.
So I want you to search the area, Reacher said. We already searched the area.
What kind of a radius?
Immediate surroundings?
No, my guy says a mile or two north.
You need to look under vegetation, in the cracks in the rock, pumping houses, anything there is. Some spot near where a vehicle could have pulled off the road. A mile or two north of the abandoned car.
My guy says not less than one, not more than two.
On the left.
He's pretty sure, Reacher said.
You got a phone number?
I'll call you back, Reacher said. An hour from now.
He hung up. The woman with the baby was gone. Alice was still staring at him.
What?
She said. We should have focused on Eugene before.
Why?
Because what's the one solid fact we've got here?
What?
Carmen didn't shoot Sloop. That's what.
That's an opinion. Not a fact.
No, it's a fact, Alice. Believe me, I know these things.
She shrugged. Okay, so?
So somebody else shot him. Which raises the question, why? We know Eugene is missing, and we know Sloop is dead. They were connected, lawyer and client. So let's assume Eugene is dead, too, not just missing. For the sake of argument. They were working together on a deal that sprung Sloop from jail. Some kind of a big deal, because that isn't easy. They don't hand out remissions like candy. So it must have involved some heavy-duty information. Something valuable. Big trouble for somebody. Suppose that somebody took them both out. For revenge. Or to stop the flow of information.
Where did you get this idea?
From Carmen, actually, he said. She suggested that's how I should do it. Off Sloop and make like stopping the deal was the pretext.
So Carmen took her own advice?
No. Carmen's parallel, Reacher said. She hated him. She had a motive. She's all kinds of a liar. But she didn't kill him. Somebody else did.
Yes, for her.
No, Reacher said. It didn't happen that way. She just got lucky. It was a parallel event, like he was run over by a truck someplace else. Maybe she's thrilled with the result, but she didn't cause it.
How sure are you?
Very sure. Any other way is ridiculous. Think about it, Alice. Anybody who shoots that well is a professional. Professionals plan ahead, at least a few days. And if she had hired a professional a few days ahead, why would she trawl around Texas looking for guys like me, hitching rides? And why would she allow Sloop to be killed in her own bedroom, where she would be the number one suspect, with her own gun?
So what do you think happened?
I think some hit team took Eugene out on Friday and covered their ass by hiding the body so it won't be found until the trail is completely cold. Then they took Sloop out on Sunday and covered their ass by making it look like Carmen did it, in her bedroom, with her own gun.
But she was with him. Wouldn't she have noticed? Wouldn't she have said?
He paused. Maybe she was with Ellie at the time. Maybe she walked back into the bedroom and found it done. Or maybe she was in the shower. Her hair was wet when they arrested her.
Then she'd have heard the shots.
Not with that shower. It's like Niagara Falls, and a .22 pistol is quiet.
How do you know where they'll find Eugene's body, assuming you're right?
I thought about how I would do it. They obviously had a vehicle of their own out there in the middle of nowhere. So maybe they staged a breakdown, or a flat. Flagged him down, forced him into their vehicle, drove him away. But they wouldn't want to keep him in there long. Too risky. 2 or 3 minutes, maximum, I figure, which is a mile or two from a standing start.
Why north? Why on the left side?
I'd have driven way north first, turned back and scouted the near side shoulder, picked my place and measured a couple of miles backward. Turned around again and set up and waited for him.
Conceivable, she said. But the sloop thing? That's impossible. They went down to that house, in Echo, in the middle of nowhere, hid out and crept in while she was in the shower?
I could have done it, he said. And I'm assuming they're as good as me. Maybe they're better than me. They certainly shoot better.
Ah, you're crazy, she said.
Maybe, he said.
No, for sure, she said. Because she confessed to it. Why would she do that, if it was really nothing at all to do with her?
We'll figure that out later. First, we wait an hour.
He left Alice with work to do and went back out into the heat. Decided he'd finally take a look at the Wild West Museum. When he got there, it was closed. Too late in the day. But he could see an alley leading to an open area and back. There was a locked gate, low enough for him to step over. Behind the buildings was a collection of rebuilt artifacts from the old days. There was a small one-cell jailhouse and a replica of Judge Roy Bean's courthouse and a hanging tree. The three displays made a nice direct sequence. Arrest, trial, sentence. Then there was Clay Allison's grave. It was well tended, and the headstone was handsome. Clay was his middle name. His first name was Robert. Robert Clay Allison. Born 1840, died 1887. Never killed a man that did not need killing. Reacher had no middle name. It was Jack Reacher, plain and simple. Born 1960. Not dead, yet. He wondered what his headstone would look like. Probably wouldn't have one. There was nobody to arrange it. He strolled back up the alley and stepped over the gate again. Facing him was a long, low concrete building, 2 stories. Retail operations on the first floor, offices above. One of them had Albert E. Eugene, attorney at law, painted on the window in old-fashioned gold letters. There were 2 other law firms in the building. The building was within sight of the courthouse. These were the cheap lawyers, Reacher guessed, separated geographically from the free lawyers in Alice's row and the expensive lawyers who must be on some other street. Although Eugene had driven a Mercedes-Benz, maybe he did a lot of volume, or maybe he was just vain and had been struggling with a heavy lease payment. He paused at the crossroads. The sun was dropping low in the west, and there were clouds stacking up on the southern horizon. There was a warm breeze on his face. It was gusting strong enough to tug at his clothes and stir